I just wanted to say that when we study, have this kind of study, it's very idealistic. And it's pointed toward the most ideal practice. It might seem unreachable. How does this apply to me? How can I do this, right? So one of the problems that we have is facing some kind of idealistic understanding, which is true, but
just keep going. I'm being unidealistic.
So we have to realize that the practice that you have, you know, is just right, and the place where you are is just right. And like I said this morning, we absorb this material and it works within us and is a catalyst for bringing out our practice, a catalyst for bringing forth our practice and wisdom without trying too hard to do something. If you know, Suzuki Roshi used to say, if you catch the tail of a comet, people will pity you. So, although this applies to us, definitely, we shouldn't let it compare it with our own practice as this is the ideal and look at me, you know. So I think we need to be careful about that. And it's also important to realize that a lot of what is said here is already what you do. It's already what we do. But it's couched in a certain language. The sixth ancestor, Hui Nung, one of his accomplishments was to take this very highly specialized view and language and make it into and present it in an ordinary way. That's what's so nice about the Platform Sutra. So I'll present a little bit about, read a little from the Platform Sutra. But first, I want to present something from Dogen Zenji. How Dogen deals with dharmas. And in Ginjo Koan, many of us are familiar with Dogen's Ginjo Koan. I think some of us are not. But Ginjo Koan is Dogen's a touchstone for all the rest of his the fascicles of the Ginjo Koan. And the opening statement of Ginjo Koan is, when all dharmas are Buddha Dharma. When all dharmas are Buddha Dharma, there are enlightenment and delusion, practice, life and death, Buddhas and creatures. When the 10,000 dharmas are without self, there are no delusion, no enlightenment, no Buddhas, no creatures, no life, no death. So Dogen is presenting his understanding of dharma and dharmas in these two different ways. One is when all dharmas are Buddha dharma, there is. And when the 10,000 dharmas are without self, there is not. So he's presenting is and is not as a balance. So of non-duality. I'm not going to read this whole thing because I don't, Dogen is not what we're studying here. But I just want to present some of Dogen's understanding and the way he talks about dharmas. He says, to carry yourself forward and realize the 10,000 dharmas is delusion. That the 10,000 dharmas advance and realize the self is enlightenment. It is Buddhas who enlighten delusion, and it is creatures who are deluded in enlightenment. Then, in his most the central statement of Genjo Koan is, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas. To be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas is to free one's body and mind and those of others. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this traceless enlightenment is continued forever. If one examines the 10,000 dharmas with a deluded body and mind, one might suppose that one's mind and nature are permanent. But if one practices intimately and returns to the true self, it will be clear that the 10,000 dharmas are without a self. And then he says, now if a fish or a bird or fish, tries to reach the limit of its element before moving in it, this bird or this fish will not find its way or its place. Attaining this place, one's daily life, is the realization of ultimate reality. Attaining this way, one's daily life, is the realization of ultimate reality. Since this place and this way are neither large nor small, neither self nor other, neither existing previously nor just arising now, they therefore exist thus. Thus, if one practices and realizes the Buddha way, when one gains one dharma, one penetrates one dharma. When one encounters one action, one practices one action. So these are Dogen's always dealing with this same problem, and in his own way.
What book is this? Wonderful photographs that you see.
Well, this is Daido's photograph. Daido Lori.
The way of everyday life.
Yes, who just died a few months ago. He was the abbot of Maizumi Roshi's.
But the book is Maizumi Roshi, right?
It's both of them. It's Maizumi Roshi's commentary on Genjo Koan and Daido's photographs. He put this book together back in the 70s. And, of course, it's out of print, but every once in a while I find one.
What's the title again?
Huh?
What's the title again?
The Way of Everyday Life. Genjo Koan is The Way of Everyday Life. That's all it's talking about. Sounds maybe highfalutin, but it's just The Way of Everyday Life. how we understand our life. I'd like to study the Genjo Koan again. We did that some years ago, several times. The cycle of talks takes a long time to come around again. So I said that I wanted to talk about consciousness as wisdom. Someone asked about wisdom. Where does wisdom come from? Which is a good question. Where does wisdom come from? It doesn't come from anywhere. Wisdom comes when There's nothing blocking it. Wisdom is our innate nature. It doesn't come from someplace. It's not like a thing that comes somewhere that you can get. It's simply your intrinsic nature when it's unveiled. So that's why we say to not gain anything. Practice is a non-gaining activity. If you try to gain something, you're reaching outside of yourself. And when you reach outside of yourself, you're going away from yourself. So whatever it is that you reach for is inside, so to speak, even though there's no inside or outside. But provisionally speaking, inside is what we're, is where it is where your treasure chest is. That's why the sutra is talking about letting go and understanding what is real and what is not real. When you understand what is real and what is not real, then you have a choice of letting go of what is not real so that what is real can emerge. So in the eight levels of consciousness, even though there are nine, we talk about eight, because you can't really talk about nine. because nine has no special characteristics. Nine is like the accomplished thing. Like, as I was saying, Vairochana, Dharmakaya. So Dharmakaya is not something that we can describe, but it's the basis for all the dharmas. So stillness is the basis for movement. Emptiness is the basis for form. Nothing is the basis for something. Although emptiness is not nothing, it's no special thing. It has no special shape or form, but it's expressed as the various forms. So if we want to understand, or if we want to see emptiness, we have to look at form. Because all forms are emptiness. But if you try to see something called an emptiness, even if you look at the sky, that's just a metaphor for emptiness. So empty means that nothing has its own inherent nature. Empty of inherent nature is emptiness. But it pervades everything. So when we realize the emptiness of all forms, then wisdom arises spontaneously. It's called prajna. There's the word prana, which means information, or it means knowledge, which is different. Sometimes the word prajna is used to mean knowledge, but basically it means wisdom. So wisdom means seeing things as it is. In an undistorted way. So there's something called paravritti. Paravritti means turning or transformation. It's like a door that's maybe a secret door, a door that turns like this, like on a stage set. And the door here is consciousness, eight consciousnesses. And then when it's turned, it's called four wisdoms, four aspects of wisdom. And it's not that it turns into wisdom. It's that it's not a change in substance. It's simply a change in wording. So that which is the transformation is that which is impeding wisdom becomes wisdom. So that's why we say sometimes big ego is big Buddha. So we don't say big ego is bad necessarily, although it's simply ignorance. It can be bad, but it's simply basically ignorance. And when we acknowledge all the dharmas that are coming up in us, anger, love, whatever the dharmas are, good dharmas or bad dharmas, or indifferent dharmas, we should see them come up without judgment. To just see them as they are. And when we see them as they are, with concentration or with mindfulness, then we can actually examine who we are. We can see examine the feelings in the feelings, examine the thoughts, the consciousness, and so forth. So, in this way, when we examine them, we have the ability to have some space from them. So people sometimes say, how can I control my anger? And there's nothing that you can say that will help them. Because what will help them is to practice not being angry. They can't just stop being angry as a mode. Most people can't just stop being angry. You have to practice not being angry. So practice is really necessary for any kind of transformations. When you practice over and over again with your emotions and feelings, then you have some way to deal with them, because it's your mode is to practice with them and not just let them come up. So as the sutra says, mind control, meaning not controlling exactly, but with awareness, giving yourself some space. If we try to control ourselves without understanding, trying to understand, then it's just suppression. And suppression will burst out. So understanding is really necessary. When this anger comes up, well, what is this anger? Without saying, I don't like it, or it's bad, or whatever. But just to examine what it is.
Perhaps you could say not being controlled by, rather than control.
Not being controlled by, yes. Well, this is the way of not being, of helping yourself to not be controlled by. That's right. So it's not being controlled by, rather than trying to control. I think that works good well. Sometimes we just have to swallow things. I want to talk about, as I said, the wisdom, how wisdom arises from in Paravirti. So someone asked the sixth patriarch, I'm just using this as a kind of vehicle. Someone asked the sixth patriarch, Huinong, He said, Bhikkhu Chitong, a native of Xiaojiao of Anfang, had read the Lankavatara Sutra nearly 1,000 times, but he could not understand the meaning of Trikaya and the four Prajñas. Thereupon he called on the ancient and the patriarch for an interpretation. The Lankavatara Sutra was supposed to be something that Bodhidharma brought to China from India, and it's kind of puzzle sutra in many ways, because it doesn't have a lot of continuity, but it talks about mind consciousness, and it's considered one of the sutras that is authoritative on elements of mind, as we've been studying. And the four prajñas are the four wisdoms. But he says the meaning of the trikaya and the four prajñas. So I want you to bear with me numerically. There are eight levels of consciousness, right? There are four wisdoms, and there are three bodies. The three bodies you're familiar with, because I talk about them a lot. The Dharmakaya, the Dharma body, the Sambhoga body, Sambhogakaya, and you read them every time you eat a meal. And the Nirmanakaya, kaya means body. So, Dharma body, Sambhoga body, and Nirmana body. Dharmakaya is the reality or truth body, which has no special shape or form, or that's Vairochana. Vairochana Dharmakaya Buddha. He said it twice today. And then we say Sambhogakaya Lochana Buddha. Lochana means Amida Buddha. Actually, Lochana is the name for Amida, or Amida. And and then Nirvanakaya Shakyamuni. So Sambhogakaya, the sixth ancestor says, Sambhogakaya is our wisdom body. Dharmakaya is our pure body. Nirvanakaya is our wisdom body. Nirvanakaya is our activity body. Transformation body. Transformation means, in this world, everything is transforming. So this is the transformation body. Right? So those are the three bodies of Buddha. But they're your three bodies. They're not some Buddha's bodies. They're your Buddha body. So each one of us has these three bodies, is made of these three bodies. Generally, we have the Dharmakaya is our true nature, and which is what we're always trying to discover, right? Anyway. Sambhogakaya is our wisdom. When we talk about Buddha, basically we're talking about Sambhogakaya. Because Sambhogakaya, Suzuki Roshi says, Sambhogakaya is like the Buddha who wrote the sutras. But who wrote the sutras? Shakyamuni didn't write the sutras. There were no written down sutras until 400 years after Shakyamuni died. So it's the wisdom that's the Buddha wisdom within us. And many, we don't know who wrote the sutras, but there's some thread of something that Shakyamuni presented that was the germ for the sutras. And then Nirmanakaya is Buddha in the world of activity. So these are the three bodies of Buddha. The Trikaya, the three bodies. Tri means three, kaya means body. So these are our three bodies. We also, when we talk about the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, That's you. You are Buddha, you are Dharma, you are Sangha. Each one of us is Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. In the same way. And actually, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha is a kind of same thing as the Trikaya. When you think about it. So Bhikkhu Chithong, a native of Shaozhou of Anfang, had read the Lakavatara Sutra nearly 1,000 times, but he could not understand the meaning of the Trikaya and the four pranyas. I'll talk about the four pranyas. Thereupon he called on the patriarch for an interpretation. And so the patriarch says, as to the three bodies, explained the patriarch, the pure Dharmakaya is your essential nature, the perfect Sambhogakaya is your wisdom, and the myriad Nirmanakaya are your actions. So you are Shakyamuni Buddha. In the old Meal Sutra chant, in the original one that we had in Japanese, which we used to chant, they said, homage to the Nirmanakaya Shakyamuni Buddhas all over the world. Meaning, you are Shakyamuni Buddha. Your practice is Shakyamuni's practice. There's no difference between you and Shakyamuni except 2,500 years and a little more wisdom. So if you deal with these three bodies apart from the essence of mind, there will be bodies without wisdom. If you realize that these three bodies have no positive essence of their own, because they are only the properties of the essence of mind, I don't understand that, you attain the Bodhi of the four prajnas. If you realize that these three bodies have no positive essence of their own, or because they are only the properties of the essence of mind, right, so they have to be blown up by the essence of mind. You know, like a balloon, you know, the essence of mind blows into the balloon comes up as you. The breath of life is breathed into you. So these bodies have no positive essence of their own because they're only the properties of the essence of mind. You attain the Bodhi of the four prajnas. So listen to my stanza. The three bodies are inherent in your essence of mind, by development of which the four prajnas are manifested. Thus, without shutting your eyes and your ears to keep away from the external world, in other words, don't go someplace, you may reach Buddhahood directly. Now that I have made this plain to you, believe it firmly, and you will be free from delusions forever. I wish it was that easy. Follow not those who seek enlightenment from without. These people talk about Bodhi all the time, but they never find it, because they're always searching for it someplace. And then he says, may I know something about the four prajnas? Asked Chithong. If you understand the three bodies, replied the patriarch, you should understand the four prajnas as well. So your question is quite unnecessary. If you deal with the four prajnas apart from the three bodies, there will be prajnas without bodies, in which case they would not be prajna. So you need both. So the patriarch then uttered another stanza. The mirror-like wisdom is pure by nature. So mirror-like wisdom is alaya-vijñāna. But alaya-vijñāna turns paravṛtti, it becomes the mirror-like wisdom, which reflects everything as it is. So this is called the mirror mind, which has no, because alaya-vijñāna can do this, because alaya-vijñāna is neither pure nor impure, and does not make decisions. It really has no mind of its own. There's no ego in Alaya Vijnana. It simply is the consciousness that allows pure and defiled dharmas to arise. It's the receptacle. Yeah.
You know, when you started, you talked about this being an idealistic teaching. But just now, did you read that thing, what he said about if there were no bodies, there'd be no wisdom? Can you read that line here? Can you read it?
Oh, okay. Well, he's saying that bodies without the wisdom are disembodied. A wisdom without bodies cannot. The wisdom needs a body.
Right. So that the materialistic part of this is that all of these teachings seems like they're relevant to us because we actually have bodies.
Yeah.
And if we didn't have bodies, they wouldn't be of any. They would have.
Yeah.
They'd be pointless.
I'm not saying it's not relevant to us at all.
No. I didn't say you were saying it. The context for the teachings is that we have a body.
Oh yes, absolutely. So the dharmas, and that's what Dogen is saying, that without a body, the dharmas and the consciousnesses are not two. That the whole point is, of this teaching which we've been doing all day, is that, which I probably didn't get to actually, almost, is that the two divisions, the two bhagas, the seeing division and the object division. And I started to talk about that. I said, when we see, the consciousness sees, and what it sees is the object. And in between is the organ. So the organ doesn't see. The consciousness arises with seeing. So it's consciousness that sees. We all know, I mean, that's been proven. It's consciousness that sees and arises when it sees. So it seems like that the consciousness and the object are two different things. The whole point is that what appears to be two different things is not two different things. That the object, that the consciousness and the object of consciousness are one, but we divide them. Consciousness is discriminatory. The meaning of consciousness actually is discriminating. The Alaya doesn't discriminate. But the seven consciousness is the great discriminating consciousness which divides subject from object. So when you read the literature, it's always saying, no subject and object. That doesn't say much about it, right? No subject. Doesn't mean that there's no subject and object. There is. The object, the third ancestor says in the Shinshin Ming, the subject is a subject for the object. The object is an object for the subject. If you remember that. If you've ever taught it, right? Somebody did here.
You did.
Subject is a subject for the object. The object is an object for the subject. So, yes, there is subject and object, but the subject makes the object, and the object makes the subject, because they're one thing. But discrimination divides them. So it's really hard to see that, because our minds are continually discriminating.
Well, we can't, they interact.
And they're not interacting.
They're not interacting. Otherwise, they remain in their own states. So, what's their own states then?
Well, every dharma is on it's in its own dharma position. Mm-hmm. Every dharma is in its own dharma position, independent of before and after, independent of history, and independent of future. Every dharma exists in its own dharma position, as is. That's what he's saying.
whatever that means.
Well, it means that everything is momentary. Every dharma is momentary and gives way to the next dharma. And the series, what we see as continuity, is simply a series of dharmas giving way to dharmas of the same type. In other words, when we think a thought and we're acting and so forth, we don't think about dharmas in their own positions and all this, right? We think of movement, and we think in terms of large movements. We don't think in terms of incremental movements, right? So we think in terms of, I'm going to do this, and I do it, right? And a big sweeping gestures. But if you look closely, it's like a movie, one film frame after another. So every dharma is momentary. This is called the dharma of momentariness. Every dharma is momentary. And but we see it as a movie. So if you slow down enough, you experience the momentariness of each dharma. But actually, you can't slow down that much, because there's so many kasana moments in a minute, maybe a million or something like that. I don't know who counted them, but some patient monk.
A sleepless night.
Counted how many momentarinesses there are in a moment. So everything is, each dharma is in its own dharma position for momentarily, like a flash, right? But these flashings are continuous because they keep perpetuating themselves. This is called the perpetuation of dharmas. That's what the whole thing is talking about. The perpetuation of dharmas. This is the alive vijnana, the stream, like a torrent, like a rushing torrent, creating itself in a series, moment after moment. And so the sutra here says there is a time when the torrent actually comes to a halt in a form of arhatship. So when we sit zazen, we can see, I mean, we experience this rushing torrent because we're sitting still, and the mind is the alive vijnana. You can see the alive vijnana as all the thought forms that are rushing through your head. You're actually experiencing firsthand the alive vijnana as it's continually rushing through your mind. It is your mind. So when we sit still, we don't try to stop the alive vijnana because it's like a rushing torrent. You can't do that. You can, but you know it'll wash over you eventually anyway. It's like those waves out at the beach there that all these people were got wet. So and by sitting still, you can see it. When you're not sitting still, you're moving within it, and you can't see it because there's no contrast. So we need this contrast to be able to see it. But we don't try to do anything with it. This is called stopping, actually. It's sitting still, you know, and letting the mind rush, and being mindful of that from time to time, without it affecting us. So you become independent of alaya vijnana, actually. And without discriminating. So consciousness, discriminating consciousness, if you really are sitting still without averting feelings and without grasping them and without trying to stop the flow and just letting everything come as it comes, let everything go as it goes, you're empty. And you can conform to whatever is happening. We hate conforming, right? But in Zazen, you have to conform. You have to take the shape of whatever is happening. If you resist the shape of what's happening and try to form some other shape, that's called suffering. That's why we sit sashin, we let go so that we can flexible. I always talk about flexibility of both mind and body. That's what you have to be able to do. Suzuki Roshi talks about soft mind, which doesn't mean stupidity, it means a lot, it's like grass. When the wind blows, the grass lies down. The grass conforms to the wind. If the grass doesn't conform to the wind, it gets torn up. But when the wind goes by, the grass comes back up. And it's not a problem. And this is what Master Hua was talking about when he talked about emptiness. When you punch somebody who is empty, then your fist just goes in, but there's no reaction. So you just conform to the punch. Roll with the punch. Roll with the punches. So, and this is how we can meet with everyone. Because we don't have anything special that's breakable. And we can conform to whoever we meet. This Avalokiteshvara's practice is to conform to every person, to every situation, in various guises. When you meet a man, you conform to the man. When you meet a woman, you conform to the woman. Whatever situation, you know what your place is in the situation. Without getting caught by the situation. And it's not like you plan anything, it's just when there's nothing there, you know what to do. So, the patriarch then uttered another stanza. The mirror-like wisdom is pure by nature. So, this is the purity of alive as jnana. This all depends on manas, because manas is the defiled consciousness, and the other consciousnesses become tainted through manas, which is what we call our ego, our false sense of self. When manas, it becomes turns on its base, is purified, meaning it no longer is deluded, thinking that Alayavijnana is its true self. Alayavijnana is not the true self of manas or manavijnana. Meaning, thoughts, feelings, and so forth. So, when manas turns, it becomes the wisdom of equality. You see the sameness throughout all of the diversity. You see the thread that runs through all the diversity. The sameness that runs through all the diversity. Which is horizontal, everything is leveled because you're seeing the emptiness of all phenomena.
So that's why Rosa Parks didn't conform?
Well, that's a different situation. She conformed to something else.
That's right.
She didn't conform to...
That would be the equality. She conformed to the equality.
Yeah, she conformed to the equality.
So that's sometimes when you meet something, you're not always conforming to that thing.
Well, conforming means taking the proper shape.
It's wisdom appearing.
Yeah, it's the wisdom.
So it doesn't mean that you conform to everything that appears.
No, it doesn't mean that you do what somebody else does. It means that you take the shape which...
if there's violence, for example, you try to prevent it. Yeah. On what kind of violence.
Right. So you take the shape of the violence, but you don't participate in the violence. In other words, when you... In Aikido, you meet the opponent, but you meet the opponent on your own terms. And you use the opponent's off balance, or you use the opponent's own body weight to throw them off balance. So that's conforming to the situation, because you're not fighting the person. You're simply using the person's own aggression to defeat them, if you want to call it defeating. It's not called defeating, simply setting things straight. So when manas turns, then it becomes the equality, but that's... The wisdom of equality means to see the Buddha nature in everything. So that one, it doesn't mean that hierarchy is eliminated. Because when the wisdom of when consciousness turns, it becomes the wisdom of differentiation. That's the vertical. So vertical means that everything has its own place, which is different than every other place. So the wisdom of equality is sameness, and the wisdom of differentiation is difference. Recognizing the qualities of each individual thing. So it's not like life is flat. Life is dynamic as well as flat. So this is the balance between leveling and dynamism. You realize the dynamic quality of each individual thing, and appreciating all of the separate existences, and seeing the truth of each separate existence, because you realize the emptiness of all dharmas. You realize the emptiness of all dharmas, and everything is the same, and you realize the emptiness of all dharmas, and realize that each dharma is different. So difference and sameness are balanced. And right where those two meet is where life takes place. So, and then he says, this is called the equanimity wisdom, and the all-discerning wisdom that sees things intuitively without going through the process of reasoning. I like that. I never saw that before. I realized that he said that in that way, but that's intuitive. But usually it's not worded that way, but I like that. The all-discerning wisdom, which sees things intuitively without going through the process of reasoning, that's intuition. Usually it's that you see the differences in the hierarchy. Hierarchy is an interesting word because we usually think of hierarchy as power. You know, the people at the top of the hierarchy are the people that have the power, which is true. But if you don't associate hierarchy with power, you can see, as I was talking about this morning, that every part of the plant has a purpose. And when all the elements of the plant, or all the elements of the Zen Center, or whatever you want to call it, are totally in place, then the whole flower is working well. The flower doesn't say, I'm better than the roots. The leaves don't say, I'm better than the flower or the stem. All of the parts of the flower are equal. That's this. They're all equal because without them, the plant doesn't work. But yet they're all different. And they're in a hierarchy. So the plant works. Because none of the parts are jealous of each other. They're all doing their function. And the plant thrives because they're all equal. It's just like the house. The beam, the foundation. You can point to any place on the house and you say, there's the house. So then there's the all-discerning wisdom. No, I'm sorry. The all-performing wisdom, which is the sense consciousnesses, five senses, are called the all-discerning wisdom when a wisdom arises. And they have to, it says, the all-performing wisdom has the same characteristics as the mirror-like wisdom. And there's the reason why it says, when Buddhahood is attained, the first five vijñanas, that's the senses, will be transmuted to the all-performing wisdom, and the alaya vijñana to the mirror-like wisdom. The all-performing wisdom is how to actually act in the world. So when the four wisdoms, consciousnesses are turned or transformed, they're called wisdom. It doesn't mean that wisdom is not there. It does. Vijnana is not there. Just that they're called wisdoms, because wisdom is what is expressed. And the first five are the wisdom of activity. So the mirror wisdom, the horizontal wisdom, the vertical wisdom, and the activity. So when all the consciousnesses are turned into wisdom, then you act out that in the world, through your body and senses. That's our sensory world. So the whole thing is a wonderful system. And it also applies to the five ranks. But I'll save that for later. So So actually four systems that work, that are kind of combined to express this wisdom. It's really an interesting way of expressing things. So Tozan also used this, I believe he used this to express his five ranks. So then, the patriarch says, the first five vijnanas, which are consciousness dependent respectively on the five sense organs, right? That's the fifth one, or the first one. The first five. And the alive vijnana, the storage of universal consciousness, and transmuted to prajna in the Buddhist age, whatever that means. I think, I know what that means, but whenever it does, maybe when that happens, it is the Buddhist age. While the mano vijnana, and manas and mano are transmuted in the bodhisattva stage. So these so-called transmutations of vijnana are only changes of appellations and not a change of substance. In other words, they just change the name, but not the substance. When you are able to free yourself entirely from attachment to sense objects, at the time these so-called transmutations take place, you will forever abide in the repeatedly arising dragon samadhi, naga samadhi. That's pretty nice. So upon hearing this, Chitong realized suddenly the prajna of his essence of mind and submitted the following stanza to the ancestor. Intrinsically, the three bodies are within our essence of mind. They're not somewhere else. When our mind is enlightened, the four pragyas will appear, or the four wisdoms. Right? When bodies and pragyas absolutely identify with each other, we will be able to respond in accordance with their temperaments and disposition to the appeals of all beings, no matter what forms they may assume. That's what I was saying. So this is the bodhisattva wisdom, which enables one to meet everyone and conform to what's necessary to meet each person. Some people are hard to meet, but how do we meet each person? That's a really good question. Without giving into anger or resentment or being caught by the person. That's really our practice. How do you, you know, we do get angry if we listen to the mutterings of our mind. If we really pay attention to the mutterings of our mind, we're always complaining about something. You know, he's complaining about something. And we complain, it takes the form of disgust or anger or disappointment or, you know, wishes for their demise and stuff like that. So this goes on all the time, you know. And then when we act out, what's there? What do we act out with? So we don't always express, you know, all those thoughts that we have are contained in it, are thrown into the garbage can of the alive vijnana. And the seeds are there. So we keep doing this, you know. Just watch your mind when you're driving. You know. Listen to your mind. We think, I'm angry. I'm showing some ill will toward this person, but then we're past them and it's all gone, right? You don't hold on, but you can, you know. People shoot each other, road rage, right? So we have road rage going on in our mind a lot, even though we don't act out. So some seed is thrown in there, but it's a seed that's not, if we have good disposition, it's a seed that's weak. The weak seeds are strong seeds. So if you have a strong seed that you can't control, then you will shoot somebody. You know, it happens all the time, more and more. Maybe we just hear about it more. So he says, we shall be able to respond in accordance with their temperaments and dispositions to the appeals of all beings, no matter what forms they may assume. There are some people that we can't help. We have to realize that there are some people we can't help. I mean, I know that there are some people I can't help. When I first started doing this, I thought, I can meet everybody. You know, I was a taxi driver for 6 years, you know, and I met everybody. When you're a taxi driver, you meet everybody. Everybody. So I thought, well, I can meet everybody. But there were people that I realized I really could not help. And in order to help somebody, I would have to completely go to hell with them and spend all my time there, and that would be the end of my life. And it doesn't work. So there are people that are just difficult, and will use you if you're not careful, if you don't understand that that's what's happening. So little by little we realize that some people can practice here, some people they should go somewhere else. And there are various ways of dealing with that, but not everyone. Otherwise, we'd have a kind of madhouse. Yes?
Well, I'm sorry not to criticize you, but obviously your practice is not advanced as it
was. Right.
That's
true.
Where he says, what I express is the Buddha Dharma. If anyone thinks that I am speaking incorrectly, all you have to do is bring up your reasons, and we will investigate them. I can meet any of your objections. You can come at me with objections, and I can answer them all. That includes all the people in the entire world, no matter what their nationality. And then he says, I am capable of making tongue transplants as well as brain transplants. If their brains are unclear, I can give them a new set. So you have a way to go.
I do. I agree.
That's your why.
Thank you for that.
Thank you for not being capable.
Well, at least I admit it.
But what if it's true?
Well, it's true. I'm sure it's true.
Is he dead?
Yeah. He died.
Nobody can do it for him.
So he says, to start by seeking for the Trikaya and the four pranyas is to take an entirely wrong course. For being inherent in us, they are to be realized and not to be sought. So that's why it's not good to say either one, but it's better to say a realization of enlightenment appeared rather than I got enlightened. So to try to grasp or confine them is to go against their intrinsic nature. So you can't hold on. And then he says, through you, sir, I am now able to grasp the profundity of their meaning. And Huineng says, no, this guy whose name I can't remember. Though you, sir, through you, I'm able to grasp the profundity of their meaning, and henceforth I may discard forever their false and arbitrary names. Note, having grasped the spirit of a doctrine, one may dispense with the names used, since all names are makeshifts only. It's true. So it's a little bit of a talk about the three bodies, and he doesn't really talk about the eight aspects, but the eight consciousnesses, but he does talk about prajna and the three bodies.
Maybe you should move your mic down just a little bit.
Oh yes, my beard is talking.
Your beard is talking.
Yeah, you hear my beard. So, do you have anything to discuss? Is it all clear? Because I want you to make a fool of yourself by asking a question. Yes.
This is how far I got. This is, like you mentioned, this that first sentence or something. But what's the relationship of all of this to the Abhidharma? What's the
Abhidharma? Yes. Okay. Well, the Abhidharma is a way of studying the dharmas. In other words. I think the purpose of Abhidhamma was by the so-called Hinayana, the various schools, to see into the nature of dharmas, for the purpose of realizing that the dharmas have no self. There's no pudgala, there is no real self, right? One of the problems with Abhidhamma was they realized the emptiness of a self, that there was no true self, what we call the self was just a collection of dharmas, right? But so they thought the self was unreal, but they mostly thought that the dharmas were real. So then somebody like Vasubandhu comes along and says, and Nagarjuna as well, that it's not just the self that's not real, not substantial, but the dharmas also. I'm surprised they didn't know that. Maybe they did, but that was their position. So is it called ends and non-ends? Ends means is. Non-ends means isn't. So the Savastivadins, for instance, felt that dharmas are real, and so that was the kind of, they didn't go far enough, right? Yeah. So that's the difference. And so what Vasubandhu was trying to say is that both dharmas and self are the same.
And was there like a period of time between them, or how long a period?
Well, this is an interesting point because people say, in the old days they used to say, well, the Pali Sutras came first in the Abhidhamma, and that the Mahayana is later. But I think that probably the flowering of the Mahayana was later. But modern scholars believe that they both were incepted at the same time. So, but the Mahayana took longer. And so in the monasteries weren't just one school necessarily. But various schools developed within a monastery. And so the germs of the Mahayana took this course. And the germs of the seeds of the Hinayana took this course. and they developed in different ways, but the Mahayanists insist that when the Buddha spoke, people understood him in different ways. So he'd say one thing, and these people understood it this way, and these people understood it that way. And I can understand that when I say something. Some people understand it this way, and some people understand it that way. You know? So, and some people misunderstand it. So these people, you know, they spent years and years and years, you know, dealing with these questions.
Kind of a silly question, but in your write-up, you talked, what are little boys made of?
Yeah.
Snails and puppy dogs and girls. That's what little boys are made of. What are little girls made of? Sugar and spice and everything nice. That's, how did that pop into your head? It just came to you.
Well, because it's true.
Well, then you said,
after all this talk,
really?
I came back to the conclusion that girls are made of sugar and spice and everything nice, and boys are made of sticks and snails and puppy dog tail. So, those are all dharmas. Right? Those are the dharmas that we're made out of. Anyway. because I was thinking of something, you know. They were human people.
Something to hook us.
Something to hook you. Yeah. Not to, you know. Not because Abhidhamma, this is, you know, this is quasi-Abhidhamma that I'm doing. It's not real Abhidhamma. I'm just using this as without an appellation. But I thought that when people see Abhidhamma, they go, oh my God, you know, lists and lists of dharmas and stuff, you know. And I myself was never attracted to Abhidhamma. When I first saw that, I went, my God. Because with the way it's presented in the literature, it's repetitions and repetitions and repetitions of, you know, you repeat a lot the same line, and then it gives a little different, you know, and then the same line and the reason for that is because in India in the old days, written word was not so common, and people memorized. So the Abhidhamma was set up in a way that was very repetitious in order to, like a sing song, so that people could memorize it. And but we, you know, write it all out. Writing for us is very common, so we would rather see the written word than sing the Abhidhamma over and over again. So when you read that sing-song stuff, it just seems like stupid representation, repetition. I was totally turned off by, you know, that. But little by little I know that especially after reading Master Hua's presentation of Vasubandhu, the connection between Abhidhamma and Mahayana, Mahayana Abhidhamma, which is a little more, talks more about emptiness and reality. So I could see how, because I'm interested in the study of the eight consciousnesses. That's a big. I'm very interested in that, and the way the dharmas and the eight consciousnesses come together was very interesting to me, and so that's why I wanted to present that.
There's also the sixth consciousness of right. Mind. The mind, you know. Knows smells and the mind perceives thought bubbles or something like that. So where does that fit into this?
Well, that's the sixth consciousness.
So that is the mono
Manavijnana.
So right, you said it's also the collection of the five sense consciousnesses. So it's sort of like the thoughts are.
It's the thought process.
Are formed out of. But aren't they actually different?
It's the consciousness that discriminates between the sense consciousnesses. It is the sense consciousness. It's the consciousness of all the senses.
Well, I was
when you say
it's like there's six. We have that in India or in Japan. They consider the mind just to be another sense organ, like the eyes, and what the mind sensed was thoughts.
Well, which mind do you mean?
Well, in the sense of us having six senses rather than just five senses.
Yes. Well, yeah, people say six senses, or the sixth sense, right?
Well, this is like the difference between Eastern thought and Western thought.
Well, I don't know about the difference between Eastern thought and Western thought, but this way of individuating is not careless. So the sixth level of consciousness is associated with the five sense consciousnesses, right? But it's not a sense consciousness. It's the individuating consciousness of the senses.
Individuating
meaning this is seeing, this is hearing, this is touching, this is smelling. You say, oh wow, what a great aroma. That's the sixth consciousness that's saying that.
Okay. Yeah, it's funny. I've always heard it in sort of this very simplistic way that the mind is like just another one of the sense organs, and what it senses is thoughts, but
I think that's a different mind than the sixth consciousness.
See, we don't talk about mind. We just talk about consciousness. Yeah. See, the thing about I remembered this. This is a little different, but when the eight consciousnesses are turned, then the wisdoms take the place of a self. So we say, well, what's left? You know, if there's no self, what is it that does things? Well, it comes out of wisdom instead of out of self. Whatever our actions are come out of wisdom instead of out of self. So, wisdom takes the place of a false self.
If one sees with their ears and smells with their eyes, which consciousness is operating there?
Well, the sixth consciousness is just mixed up. Alan has maybe a lot.
No, I have a technical question. Why don't you finish that?
I think that's illustrating the non-differentiation of directly perceiving.
So would that be like the seventh consciousness transform into wisdom?
I don't know. I don't want to speculate, but I understand your question.
But there's a koan to that.
When Tonghung woke up, he said, now I see that when you understand, something like that, paraphrasing, when you see through your nose and smell through your eye or something like that. I want to know, but I can't remember. I think so.
Can I follow up on Ko's question?
Yes.
I was reading a novel the other day, and this character in the novel was there were two blind characters, and one of them had a damaged organ.
So what kind?
A damaged organ. Their eyes didn't work. The other one, they decided by testing, actually the eye worked fine, the organ worked fine, but the consciousness was not able to create perception. So there was a damage in the mind consciousness.
Yeah.
Now, when you said to Ko, I think what you said was, when you were talking about nose, it's like, oh, what a wonderful aroma.
Mm-hmm.
Now, isn't that actually a manifestation of interaction of manovijnana and manas?
Yeah.
The discrimination of the wonderful aspect of it,
right,
is that's the discriminating action of seven consciousness.
Well,
right?
Manas and manovijnana are very much connected.
Right.
They're not that separate.
Right.
Because manas is a support for manovijnana.
Right. So, but manovijnana is like a classification or classifying activity, not an evaluative activity.
It may not. I don't know. You know, this is a very tricky area. How far the manovijnana goes in making judgments. Because the manovijnana also is a thinking consciousness.
Yeah, I don't think we can separate them that much.
But I think that I thought the same thing when I said that's making a judgment on this is good. This I like it, right? But it's hard to say, you know. I like it really. That's, you know, is that ego or is it simply a statement?
But if
a feeling.
If manovijnana wasn't functioning, you would have no way of making any kind of.
Oh, yeah, there wouldn't be any perception.
It's like that character in the novel, you wouldn't get what was coming into your nose to go through your brain.
Yeah, right. Let me find manovijnana. And we can look at that. How much time do we have?
We're actually starting about 5 minutes past.
We'll pass by 5 minutes?
We're over our schedule.
Okay, well, we'll have to
leave. Whatever you would like to do is fine. So.
We'll leave it there. But I just want to say that the five sense consciousnesses are an entity. The six sense consciousness is The sense consciousnesses are the doorways for sensory perception. And the sixth consciousness is the perceptor.
It's like formations, perceptions.
Well, I just want to say that the six consciousnesses are the perceptors, are the doorways. You know, you walk in the door and then someone greets you. That's the. It says, "Oh, Ko." This is Ko.
What a handsome.
That's
guy.
Joe. And that's Mike. But you're the one that walks down the hallway and through the door. As a sense of consciousness, reminds me of Woody Allen. What do you call it? And the penis. and we're going through this.
No fair.
No, you don't remember that?
Oh
my God. Did you hear this? What do you know this movie? Where he has all these guys dressed up as sperms, and then he has a big huge penis. And he said, "Okay, everybody get in." and then you shoot it off.
That's a good way to
end.
Where does this fit into the long run?
I was just curious, I don't know how to ask this, but what trouble does mono consciousness cause when it's defiled by mana?
Well, maybe it starts judging. I don't know. That's a good question. It's a very good question. I'll have to research that one. I can't say that I know. But it's a good question. What are the problems that manas has when... I mean, manavijnana has when manas is, you know... Well, like, it's easy. Just think about it yourself. What, you know, your perception... How do you perceive what comes through your senses? Do you perceive what comes through your senses accurately, or do you see what comes through your senses in a tainted way? In other words, through partiality. As a matter of fact, that's really great. It just opens that whole thing up, because what we see through partiality is not what is real. So even though we have input through our senses, you know, like you say, sometimes we say, oh, I know what that is. I've heard that 1,000 times, but you're not hearing it because you're saying, I heard that 1,000 times, but you never heard it before. You just think you heard it before because there was something like that that you heard. It seems exactly the same. So what you hear, do you hear it directly, or do you hear it tainted with what you think you're hearing? I think that's how mana vijnana is influenced by manas. Because you don't hear, we don't hear it as it really is, and we don't see it as it really is. We don't feel it as it really is. So, you know, when you take peyote, there's this magic thing where you really see something as you think as it is. You touch something, you know, because that's those senses of having done that before, it's cut off. So now, I'm not saying you should do that. You probably already did, but.
You can read about that zigzag zen. It's in the library. Zigzag zen.
So, you know, we don't see things freshly. Always. Sometimes we do, you know. After you go swimming, you have a great sense of sensory perception. And after you do certain, you know, we were talking about exercise and running and all that. That kind of clears up your senses, but often we're foggy, you know. And the sense of repetition, we get tired, we cut off things, you know. We compartmentalize and shut off a lot of our sensory perceptions. So when manas become purified, then the sensory perceptions become very crisp and clear. And we don't say, I hear something. We say, something is heard. There is hearing. Hearing has heard something. When we sit zazen, we don't say, I am sitting zazen. Just there is this body sitting on a black cushion. As Figuruji said, Just painful legs sitting on a black cushion. So, And as Ross said, when the sixth sense, when the sixth consciousness is purified, then you can hear through your eyes. And I won't explain how, because I don't know. Well, I had a good time, I don't know about you. Oh, and before, first thing first. Before we leave, I want to thank Jake for being the guiding us through the sesshin, and Alan and
there's still some zazen.
Thank you.
I know there's still zazen, but you know, I can still thank people before the end. It's easier for you to do it this way. And Leslie for leading the cooking.
Gary too.
Oh, Gary.
Is that her chip?
Yeah, another day.
And
Diane for arranging the work. And all of us for being here.
Can we thank you for the teaching?
If you want to, yes.
Thank you.